July the 15th. This is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us. Coming up, another deadly attack in France, this time in Nice.
The country has only just begun to shake off its anxiety and grief that really kind of settled into people after the November attacks in Paris.
Also ahead, the U.S. seeking Russian cooperation in Syria, the latest in the race for the U.S. president, plus the return of a longtime favorite music honors program. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. A truck driver who steered his speeding truck into a crowd in France killed many dozens and injured dozens more. All of this happened late Thursday in the city of Nice, as we hear from reporter Vivian Walt, who speaks with my colleague Lori London.
Well, what we hear is that there was a very, very heavy truck. I mean, there are many pictures of it now, that plowed into a crowd of people in Nice along the seafront promenade, which is called the Promenade des Anglais. Everybody was out tonight. It's Bastille Day, the most important public holiday in France. And in every single town and village across the country, it's customary for people to come out for fireworks displays. So the street was packed. It's, obviously a warm summer's night. The truck plowed into the crowd and actually kept moving for about 150 feet, according to people down in Nice. The death toll has been rising very quickly.
Obviously, this would appear to be intentional. Is that what you're hearing?
Yes, there's absolutely no doubt about it. And I think that, the assumption and the very quick assumption from the police, the local officials and the government was that this was a terrorist attack. The police opened fire on the truck and killing the driver, and the other person in the truck has now fled and is on the run. So certainly this was not an accident. It was an intentional attack.
What are people in France feeling, given what continues to be a situation where people are outside enjoying the beautiful weather and, again, an attack in France?
This will be an extremely unsettling and very distressing situation for the country. I would say that the country has only just begun to shake off its anxiety and grief that really kind of settled into people after the November attacks in Paris, when 130 people were killed. And if you recall, that was the second attack of 2015 after the Charlie Hebdo attacks about 18 months ago, when about 17 people were killed in Paris. So the country has been under a state of emergency for 8 months now. There are literally thousands of armed soldiers on the streets, at department stores, sporting events, public train stations, and so on. And so for the French, it really is completely mystifying as to what more could be done to try avoid terrorist attacks that hasn't been done already, or whether this is simply a situation that everybody now has to accept, in which nobody really knows how and where and when the next terrorist attack might occur.
Certainly we're not expecting a vehicle to start plowing over people. It's certainly not like the attacks are similar. They all seem to be different.
Well, exactly. I mean, the one way to look at this, which I suppose in some strange way might be a positive way to look at it, is that there were no arms involved in this attack. And the question is, could they not get arms in Nice? One doesn't really know. But the fact is that they managed to commit really a mass casualty attack in the middle of a crowded city, even without a single weapon. And so it really is a terrible and almost impossible conundrum for the police and the government to figure out how to avoid another terrorist attack, and whether, you know, all the intelligence and security in the world can possibly do that. Don't forget, this was like a wonderful event. Everybody is out tonight. The country's been on holiday today. There have been parades in the street, and the weather is wonderful. And also, this is after the month-long football championship, the Euro 2016, which ended just 4 days ago. Everybody thought that that was going to be the prime target for attack. And when the event ended last Sunday, there was really a kind of palpable sense of relief in the country, with people feeling, wow, you know, we came through that and there was no attack, so maybe the threat is over.
That is reporter Vivian Walt speaking with International Edition's Lori London. We should note that the dead attacker, named as a 31-year-old French-Tunisian who lived in Nice, has not been confirmed to be working for Islamic State. Some media are reporting that the truck contained weapons and that there was an exchange of gunfire between the attacker and the police, and even that there might have been more attackers on the truck. None of that has been confirmed by French authorities so far. French President François Hollande immediately called an emergency meeting at the Interior Ministry's crisis center in Paris, and then he spoke through an interpreter.
This is of an act of which a terrorist attack cannot be ignored, and this is of absolute horror. And it is clear that we have to do everything to ensure that we can fight against the scourge of terrorism.
And in Mongolia, attending an Asia-Europe meeting, Belgian Foreign Minister Didier Reynders spoke with reporters.
Yes, I was here to talk about the fight against radicalization and to express our experience in Belgium about that, due to the fact that we have also had a terrorist attack in March, on the 22 of March. And of course, it was a good moment to try to exchange the best practices, but today it will be first of all to think about the victims and to try to help the French authorities.
Here in the U.S., President Obama condemned in what he called the horrific terrorist attack and the slaughter of innocent civilians, and he directed American officials to offer all assistance possible to French authorities. VOA will stay on top of developments coming out of that Nice attack. Be sure to check our website at voanews.com, as well as the VOA mobile app for updates. Among the other stories we're staying on top of, Cambodian Americans say they're going to be serious about this election in the U.S. EU chief blasts new British prime minister's cabinet, plus an opposition in Zambia demanding answers regarding campaigning suspension in two cities. Expanded coverage of these stories, plus a lot more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Moscow in an effort to secure Russian cooperation in anti-terror operations in Syria, despite a breakdown in U.S. relations over Ukraine, NATO, and other issues that have left both sides simmering with a level of distrust. Syria analyst David Lesh of Trinity University tells VOA's Victor Beatty he believes since the Russians intervened last September in Syria, the Obama administration has increasingly acquiesced to Russian policy objectives in Syria.
We've been moving closer and closer to Russia's definition of the strategic environment in Syria. Kerry's going to coordinate not only military activities, but obviously try to get some sort of agreement on how to restart the stalled negotiations. I think the Obama administration is reasonably confident that Moscow wants a political settlement. And in my opinion, I think they're right. Moscow does indeed want a political settlement. They don't want a quiet fire. Everything I've heard from sources in Moscow suggest that they're getting very worried about getting into another Afghanistan type of situation. They also realize that they have a favorably disposed, relatively speaking, administration in Washington with which to work to try to bring about a political settlement. I think what the Obama administration is realizing, however, is that it appears that Moscow has a little less influence on Bashar al-Assad and the Syrian regime than we had hoped. Because, again, I think we were banking on Russia being able to persuade Bashar al-Assad to make the necessary concessions toward a political settlement. Although we're getting closer, there still are these obstacles that have come on the political settlement front.
Kerry is fighting the clock. We're less than 3 weeks before this August ultimatum for diplomatic progress. Is it looking increasingly unlikely?
It's impossible. I don't think there's any chance we're going to meet that deadline. I think just in some form or fashion, restarting the negotiations would be much less any sort of settlement, but starting negotiations would be a Herculean effort at this point.
At the same time, on the ground in Syria, you have an unfolding humanitarian disaster, especially in Aleppo, but we've also heard reports of people starving to death in Madaya.
Unfortunately, the humanitarian effort is totally at the mercy of the forces on the ground. I think that's one of the reasons perhaps Kerry is going to Moscow, at the very least, convince the Syrian government to open up access for humanitarian relief in certain parts of Syria, in Aleppo, around Damascus. It happens in a very, very piecemeal fashion. That's the way it always is with the Syrian regime, because it's very, very hard to negotiate, and they'll give in just a little bit at the last second and then start all over again. The humanitarian nightmare in a strategic fashion to bludgeon the various Syrian populations and cities to accept the inevitable.
President Assad this week expressed confidence the five-year civil war will be won within months, adding that Russia's intervention helped tip the scales toward victory, calling it a crucial factor. Now, more on that humanitarian situation in Syria. UN officials are accusing the Assad government of denying medical aid to hundreds of thousands of civilians who were trapped in besieged areas. That story now from Lisa Schlein at the UN in Geneva.
A special advisor on Syria, Jan Egeland, says progress, although not enough, is being made in providing food and other relief to hundreds of thousands of Syrians in besieged areas. Egeland, however, says the United Nations and partner aid agencies have failed to provide medical care to all Syrian civilians in need in the war-torn country. He says too many people are malnourished and even starving because of lack of food. However, he notes the biggest killer is lack of medical services.
People are bleeding to death inside these areas. One-third of the war wounded are women and children. It's not fighters, it's women and children, and they are bleeding to death because they cannot be evacuated, or they're dying because they get insufficient aid, because there's no doctors there, there is no surgical equipment there, or they may even die because they are attacked in their beds in hospital.
A World Health Organization survey of 19 countries in 2014 and 2015 found that the largest number of attacks against medical facilities and health workers has occurred in Syria. The WHO director in Syria, Elizabeth Hoff, criticized the targeting and destruction of medical facilities and lack of protection for health workers. She says Syrians in besieged areas also are being denied medical care because the government removes medical items from aid convoys.
And it is particularly disturbing to us that surgical equipment, burns, that is mostly affecting civilians, are continuing to be removed from convoys, as well as antibiotics and analgesics. So people, if they are not properly treated, they cannot even die in peace because they are not receiving the necessary painkillers and palliative care that is needed in many of the besieged areas.
The United Nations has set August 1st as a deadline for restarting the Syrian peace talks. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And from Washington, this is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Jazz! America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. President Obama held a lengthy discussion with Americans about race relations and how police treat minority communities. It was part of an unusual town hall-style meeting that aired in the U.S. and worldwide. Mr. Obama is the first U.S. African-American president, and as he nears the end of his 8 years in the White House, Mr. Obama faced with a survey that's just out showing that more than two-thirds of Americans believe that race relations in the country are bad and that racial discontent and differences are at the highest point of his presidency.
The one thing I think we all have to do, though, is not paper over those differences or paper over those problems, but we do have to try to constructively solve them and not simply win talking point arguments and not just give voice to what we're feeling at the moment.
President Obama's comments were in response to last week's events in which two African-American men were shot by white police officers at point-blank range in the states of Louisiana and Minnesota. At a rally protesting those deaths, five Dallas, Texas police officers were killed. They were gunned down by an African-American gunman who said he wanted to kill white people. Also here in the U.S., the Republican Party National Convention kicks off. That'll be Monday in Cleveland, Ohio, where Donald Trump is expected to be confirmed as that party's presidential nominee. VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone spoke with my colleague Jim Stevenson as everyone is waiting for Mr. Trump to announce who he wants to have as his vice presidential running mate.
We sort of have a sense of the finalists here. As of later on Thursday, you know, the favorite, if there is one, seems to be Indiana Governor Mike Pence. We'll see if that pans out. Pence is a traditional conservative. He served six terms in the House, sort of a pre-Tea Party conservative, if you will, close to evangelical or Christian voters. So it looks as though a Pence pick would sort of shore up Trump's links with conservatives in the Republican Party, and there has been some issues there. It's probably a smart pick, if it is him, to try to unify the party on the eve of the convention.
That's essentially what we've heard Trump's aim is to find somebody who can help him actually govern if he is elected.
Yes, he has talked about that in the past because he certainly acknowledges he has no governmental experience in terms of holding office. Pence, as a House member and as a governor, certainly can cite that. I was looking through his background. Pence wrote an article or an essay, I think, in the early 90s, how he had decided to swear off negative campaigning. We'll see how that works out if it goes ahead on that, because by all accounts, this upcoming general campaign is going to be very negative.
It's a bit of a delicate selection if you think about it. I mean, you want somebody who projects the air of stability. And on the other hand, he's got to be almost a bit of an attack dog, or at least go along with what Trump is saying. And that could be a little problematic.
Yeah, and you know, certainly one of the supposed contenders we've heard about, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, is not one to shy away from the campaign fight. You know, when you look at Donald Trump, he's made his reputation as a politician as an attack dog. He almost doesn't need a surrogate attack dog. He'll do very well, thank you very much, himself on that score.
What's the probable effect for Hillary Clinton's campaign once she now knows who Donald Trump's ticket is going to entail?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, she has her own calculations to make about a running mate that might then factor into who the Democrats might want to run with her. You know, my own feeling is someone like a Christie, who's a controversial figure, he has some critics in the Republican Party don't think he's controversial or conservative enough, But Christie might have that ability to reach out to more moderate voters or swing voters. Pence is not going to excite a lot of people, I don't think, in the middle. There's polling that shows he doesn't add that much to the ticket, so it seems more of a shoring up on the conservative side. It might allow Clinton to think about, you know, a little bit more of a bolder choice. But from everything we've heard, she's approaching it in a fairly conservative way about who she'd like to pick. And one of the leading contenders on the Democratic side is Senator Tim Kaine from Virginia. Not a lot of Democrats might get excited about that, but he's considered a moderate.
We tend to get excited about the vice presidential picks, obviously. But how about the voters at large when it comes to November and they're pulling the levers and punching the tickets? Are they really paying attention to the vice presidents?
Yeah, not a lot. That's right. You know, the classic case of a pick who probably made a difference, you have to go back really to 1960 when John Kennedy, a Democrat, picked Lyndon Johnson as his vice president, helped him carry Texas and a few other southern states, and it was a close election, so it did matter. Most of the time since then, it's not been that much of a help. It's always seen as a crucial first choice for a presidential nominee to make, though, so voters do remember it.
VOA national correspondent Jim Malone, he was speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
There's an app for everything. Now there's an app to clean your car. While waiting in line at a petrol station in Lebanon one day, Rami Halal and Ralph Chowry decided to design an app so you can order a washing service directly to your vehicle. Co-founder Rami Halal. He says, we're surprised how primitive the washing method is. Driving through traffic jams and waiting in long lines just to wash your car, so why not bring the car wash to you? With the Blink My Car app, a cleaner could be at your car in 15 minutes and be done in no time. Convenience and conservation. A typical car wash uses 300 liters of water per car, but Chowry says his company's special hand-washing method uses almost no water. The vision, he says, of Blink My Car is that car washing should not take water from those who need to drink the water, take a bath, or do anything more important than washing a car. The service costs about $10, and the two entrepreneurs say business is brisk. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks, everyone, for being with us. After a six-year hiatus, VH1 held its hip-hop honors this week with a special focus on the female pioneers of the genre. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA's Soul Lounge host, Shauna Renee, about the honors.
Salt and Peppa and Spinderella, who are legendary pioneers as far as hip-hop artists, and especially female hip-hop artists, are concerned. Missy Elliott, again, another pioneer, completely changed the sound and also the imagery of hip-hop music, was honored, as well as Queen Latifah. And I think for many people, younger people, they may not have realized that she's actually a hip-hop pioneer, because now she's an actress and a television host. And then also Lil' Kim, yet another trendsetter, trailblazer, in a slightly different way, was also honored.
This was called VH1 Hip Hop Honors All Hail the Queens, which focused on the ladies, as you mentioned. Up until then, it was kind of the honors were all about the guys, you know?
Yeah, as is usually the case with hip-hop. You know, a woman would perform here or there, maybe give an honor here or there, or maybe, like in the case of, like, Russell Simmons, be included in the larger piece of work. But this was the first time where the focus was strictly on the women. And Queen Latifah talked a lot about women being in hip-hop, not only as artists, but women are consumers of hip-hop as well, and that we need to speak up, and that all lovers of hip-hop need to seek out the women who are performing and recording, maybe not in the mainstream, but certainly in the underground. But what was missing was really a discussion about how difficult it is to break into the hip-hop game as a woman, and how the expectations for a female MC are so much higher because the assumption is there can only be one. And what tends to happen when that is the case is you tend to have female MCs battling each other as opposed to working together. And we've seen that time and time and time again. So I think that was what was also very beautiful about this celebration, is that all of those women talked about how they influenced each other and that they are supporting each other even now as they've moved on to other areas in their career.
It also came in a context of national discussion about race. And Queen Latifah made a point of mentioning that there is still what she called, I think, institutional racism present in the culture. She made a point of that after she was honored.
Well, you know, exactly. And she said that as long as, and I'm paraphrasing here, as long as she goes outside to hail a cab and is passed by for a white woman, not to say that the white woman doesn't deserve the cab, that racism is alive and well, and that we have to use all of the energy, including the anger, and do something constructive and creative with it. I think she would have been remiss, and everyone else would have been remiss if they had not mentioned it. And the co-founders, actually, of Black Lives Matter, Darnell Moore and Alicia Garza, opened the show. So they set the stage. We all knew throughout the night that the discussion of race would be ongoing throughout the program.
So what do you think? Did you watch the VH1 Hip Hop Honors? Do you have a favorite female hip hop artist? Let us know. You can send Shauna a tweet at a couple of places. She is at VOA Lady DJ or at VOA underscore music. You can also follow her show, The Soul Lounge, on our website, voanews.com.
And many thanks to you. That is David Byrd, our colleague here at International Edition. Also, Shauna Renee, as you just heard. We want to remind you that VOA will stay on top of the developing story out of Nice, France, in which a huge number of people were killed when a truck crashed into them as they were celebrating Bastille Day late on Thursday. For updates, you can check out our website at voanews.com, and don't forget about the VOA mobile app as well. Many thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Latest world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In 1986, Norman Borlaug, an agronomist and Nobel laureate who was widely recognized as the father of the Green Revolution, established the World Food Prize. This annual international award, known as the Nobel Prize for Agriculture and Nutrition, recognizes the achievements of individuals who have advanced human development by improving the quality, quantity, or availability of food in the world. This year, four individuals share the prize. All four work to improve the nutritional value of staple foods and to reduce hidden hunger, mineral, and vitamin deficiency. Dr. Maria Andrade of Cape Verde, Dr. Robert Mwanga of Uganda, and Dr. Jan Lowe of the United States work for the International Potato Center. They were honored for developing the orange-fleshed sweet potato, the single most successful example of micronutrient and vitamin biofortification. Plant scientists Dr. Andrade and Dr. Mwanga bred the sweet potato to be particularly rich in vitamin A, while Dr. Lowe structured nutrition studies and programs that convinced almost 2 million households in 10 African countries to plant, purchase, and consume this food. Vitamin A deficiency is one of the most pernicious forms of undernourishment in the developing world and the leading cause of child blindness there. It causes stunting, weakens immunity in children under the age of 5, and increases their risk of dying from diarrhea, measles, and malaria by around 22%. Dr. Howarth Bowis of the United States, the founder of Harvest Plus at the International Food Policy Research Institute, pioneered the implementation of a multi-institutional approach to biofortification as a global plant breeding strategy. As a result, crops such as iron and zinc-fortified beans, rice, wheat, and pearl millet, and vitamin A-enriched cassava, maize, and orange-fleshed sweet potatoes are being tested or released in over 40 countries. These men and women represent the very best of their field, and they chose to put all their talent, energy, and skill in service of a better world, said USAID Administrator Gail Smith. Congratulations to our laureates. You have proven that science matters and that when matched with dedication, it can change people's lives. Thank you so much for everything you do to build a more food-secure world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
for, what's